the show.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, with a fun panel of roundtable folks this week to talk about taking risks and the benefits and maybe some of the drawbacks of taking risks. Stay tuned for the rest of this show. In our inbox, we are going to be talking to someone who is trying to make friends and basically has kind of put herself out there but is having difficulties. So, you know, you can get people to do things with you, but do they reciprocate and what does it really look like to make some good lasting friendships? And then our culture segment this week is with financial planner and analyst Amy Streeter. She's an expert and an author of a brand new book that is now out, and she's going to help us navigate what some of those money pitfalls are that we all have to wade through even as young adults. So, but first, let me go ahead and tell you who our podcast sponsor for this week is. It is the Connection Plus Toolbar. You can pull up Focus on the Family content, including The Boundless Show, using this toolbar, and it is very fast. For more information or to download the free toolbar, visit focusonthefamily.cvn.org. Okay, well, let me go ahead and introduce who we have on the show today. We have Martha. Hey, Martha.
Hello.
Hi, good to have you here. With a fun necklace.
Sixth show or something?
I know, you're just like a regular now. That's good. She's just an expert. So we also have Matthew John. Matthew, welcome.
Hello again.
Back. Matthew, we know, is one of our great bloggers who needs to blog some more for us. But his life's getting in the way. He has so much going on.
So popular.
I know. No. You are. One of our bloggers, also working with Campus Crusade and very busy finishing up some schooling.
Yes.
Many things going on with him. Very privileged to have Chelsea Municki back in the studio with us. Chelsea, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yay. Also one of our bloggers.
Who also needs to write more.
Our college perspective. So she's finishing up her last year at Dort College in Iowa.
Couple months
left. Going the long haul.
Yep.
So, and job hunting and seeing where God's going to take you next. So I'm sure you have some things to say about risk.
Yes, definitely.
So very exciting. And then Jen Mesko is with us. Jen, welcome.
Thank you. I guess I'm the only first-time guest here, so.
But you're not really a first-time guest because you interviewed Michael W. Smith for us, remember? She is trying
takes
to.
Takes me back,
she,
yes.
It does. She was a co-interviewer. She had to step in with Sarah Woodard when I was sick and unable to talk to Smitty. And so Jen and Sarah valiantly did that.
It's a bad day to be sick.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, next time that happens, please call me up. So.
Okay. Okay, and we'll find other people to step in. It's not like it was Bill Gaither. I mean, if it was Bill Gaither, I would have, like, wheeled in on a gurney and just been like, well, tell me about your career, you know. But Malcolm W. Smith, I was like, hey, you know, these ladies can take it.
Small potatoes.
Whoa, yeah. Mm-hmm. Jen is the editor of CitizenLink, which is our online, basically our site within our public policy arm here at Focus on the Family, citizenlink.org, and writes all the latest news briefs about what's going on Capitol Hill and beyond. So very fast-paced job.
Exciting yes, it stuff is.
There. So make sure you check that out, as well as, I mean, we talk about Rising Voice here as well. So they kind of get to work in the same sphere. So, all right, well, we are going to talk about taking risks. Some of us maybe are more natural risk takers than others. Some people get risks forced upon them, or maybe it's not a risk if it's just forced upon you. All of a sudden life just happens to you and you're like freaked out. So I want you guys to just jump in and talk briefly about when you hear the word risk, or you think that there's some element of risk that you need to take in your life, or you need to move somewhere out of your comfort zone with where you are, what kind of feelings does that elicit in you?
Well, I tend to be a very methodical person. I'll weigh the pros and cons for days and days and days before making a decision or jumping into something. But I also have moments of spurts of, holy cow, I got to do that. I've always wanted to be on The Price is Right. So I would have no problem going up on stage and be that crazy person. Other people would be totally freaked out by that and would never go for it. So I have moments.
Yeah. Okay. But generally, your pattern is more to plan ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Happening. Okay.
Yeah, I'm definitely that way, too. I would say, I mean, generally speaking, my natural bent is to be risk averse generally, but at the same time, you kind of know that that you're going to end up taking that step. It just seems like I kind of have to get pushed up to the edge of the cliff and just look over for a long time. And then eventually, I know I'm going to jump, but yeah, that usually takes a lot of thinking and a lot of, like Martha said, a lot of deliberating. But then in the end, you know all along that that's kind of the step you're going to take. So mm-hmm. I don't know why that risk aversion is there, but it is. So,
Go ahead.
Speaking of jumping off the cliff, when I think risk, I think bungee jumping or skydiving, whitewater rafting. And when you asked me to talk about it today, I had no idea what you were talking about because the decisions I make in my life, I just don't think of them as risky.
Wow. Okay. Chelsea,
I would say I'm different than the other two. I just do things. Like, I don't deliberate much or think much sometimes, and that's probably a bad thing. I like risks, so I kind of go with it. I think sometimes if I spend too much time thinking about it, then I end up not doing it. So I guess that's maybe more my inclination, is just to do things.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say I'm definitely in the same camp you are.
Yes.
I tend to be. In fact, I was telling someone the other day that when I took this job at Focus, it was the first time I'd ever moved anywhere with a job. I was the type of person that would load up my car, move somewhere. Hey, I heard this is a great place. Maybe I'll just go there. And it was a very sad day for me, actually, when I bought a home and realized that I now have stuff
to stay.
That I will no longer move in my car and stuff. So that was kind of an interesting dynamic. But I think it's an important topic to talk about, because especially for young adults, we're in this season of transition that really there's a lot of life that happens between 18 into your early 30s, probably. And it's, you know, we talk about that here on Boundless. It involves career, it involves faith, it involves worldview, it involves relationships. And there are many landmark decisions that you can and probably should, in some instances, make during this stage of your life. Do you guys ever look at any of those, like with any of those categories, and just say to yourself, it's overwhelming, or how can I put all this together and possibly even keep my life together with the many decisions to be made?
Yeah, I feel like that way now with only 2 months left of college. It's like within this semester, I feel like I have the most important decisions of my life to make. It's like, you know, where am I going to go from here? Where should I look for a job? Should I go to grad school? Where do you even start?
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it's a very risky time of life, yeah. If you might.
Well, and you're in a relationship, so you have to worry about that.
Yeah, and that was a
not
risk, too.
Not that he's
too.
Like a ball and chain, but I mean,
well, you know.
Worry being an operative
it's
term.
It's kind of like, you know, is this thing moving forward? What does that mean?
Because yeah.
You might move elsewhere.
Yeah. Exactly, and just like looking at that, if you are ready or willing to a long distance, or, you know, just weighing what God has put in your life and if that is a risk that you should take, or sticking where you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I remember my senior year of high school, I remember saying to a few people, I find it ironic that God asks us to make these decisions, like where we're going to go to school, what we're going to study, now when we're 18, when we don't have the maturity to make the decision in the first place. But since then, while I do worry about, like, you know, what should I do, I don't necessarily have this plan that I'm trying to, you know, accomplish. So it's kind of like, well, okay, do I go to grad school or do I join Campus Crusade? Eventually both of those happen, but you know, I don't really worry anymore. Am I making the right choice in God's eyes? Am I taking the right risk? But more like, is this risk going to, I don't know, cause me undue suffering or something like that, you know, because I assume God wants to teach me through suffering. So
mm-hmm.
So I don't have a plan that I'm trying to accomplish anymore. I think God's kind of disabused me of that. So it's not a risk so much in like, oh, am I going to subvert God's plan, but more just is this the best thing that I could be doing?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I like that. I was actually talking with my boss the other day, and I hope I get this right, because I think he was telling me about a guy who was batting around this idea with him and saying, you know, when you make these kinds of decisions, you look to avoid the crazy making conundrum of, can I be out of God's will and that whole thing. And he said, you know, what's prohibited in Scripture? And there are really mm-hmm. very few things that in the scope of this thing are going to be flat out prohibited
right.
That would, you know, and so look at those things and then realize that opens up a whole, you know, paradigm or a whole chasm of things that would be possibilities that you could do. And so within that, you have the freedom to move, which mm-hmm. I think is kind of cool.
It's interesting to me of just hearing all of you guys of how we interchange risk and decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And it really just comes down to making a decision of feels risky, but I think it's scary because mm-hmm. what is going to be the outcome or what are people going to think? And that can definitely be what stops us from making a decision.
Yeah. So let's kind of launch into a couple stories here. What would you guys say from your own lives have been examples of situations where you really felt you were having to step out with maybe some variables or maybe something that you didn't have the full picture scripted out for you and you were going to have to make a decision and go with it?
Well, what Martha was saying about decision making, that's what I kind of consider what I tend to do. I think about something for a long time. I research it, get everyone's opinions, and so I don't consider that a risk. But there was one instance in college. I was finishing up my junior year journalism major, and any journalism majors out there will know you need internships. That's the bottom line. Finishing up my junior year, no internships in sight. One of my professors grabbed me after class and said, you know, there's an internship nearby. You can start in a few weeks, but you need to, he wants you to know this design program. And I said, I don't know the design program. And she said, well, can you learn it by then? And I said, yes, because I needed the internship.
Good for you.
And I did learn the design program and did great in the internship and got a job out of college through that. But to me, that was more risky than buying a house or getting a different car or anything like that, because it mm-hmm. was a momentary decision that I had to make.
Yeah, that's true. It's good.
Mm-hmm. I think a big risk just recently was joining the Boundless team. I have a journalism background
that is
as well.
Risky. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always done like print journalism, so to do something that's totally online, it was like, well, this could be a great strength builder opportunity. That's ultimately why I thought, you know, this is good of thinking long term. Mm-hmm. But it was scary of, I've never done this before. I don't have a proven track record of really know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, I would say the biggest risk I can, up to that point anyway, was choosing to go on a summer project, like a summer missions trip with Campus Crusade. It was between my junior and senior years at Kansas State, and I had been wanting to actually to go on a summer project. I was planning to go to Vail, and then one of the
that is not a risk, that's just awesome.
Right? Well, yeah, especially because I'd worked at Estes Park at a mm-hmm. At a camp the summer before. I'm like, I love Colorado.
Okay, but continue.
Tough
time. Yeah. We'll try to believe you.
And I know this next thing probably isn't going to sound much of a risk either, but there was a summer project, an all-guys summer project in Juneau, Alaska. Mm. Again, you know, Crimea River, you have to go to Juneau, Alaska for the summer. but I did not want to go to that one. I just didn't like the idea of it for whatever reason. I really didn't want to be on an all-guys summer project. I was like, that. I just think that'll be a little bit ridiculous.
I think we should join girls.
Yeah.
They have a girls' summer project with her now, so it's pretty sweet. But anyway, but one of the staff guys there at K-State with Campus Crusade said, hey, you know, I see you're filling out the application. And where are you going? And I was like, oh, I think I might go to Vail. And he's like, you should come to Juneau. And I was like, And right at that moment, I kind of felt the Holy Spirit say, you know, in as much as any of us hear God speak, you know, wouldn't it be awesome to spend a summer in Alaska and to be able to tell stories from a summer in Alaska? And I thought, yeah. And then he was like, don't you think like spending a summer with a bunch of guys would be really good for you? And I was like, yeah, I suppose so. And so right then I switched my options from mm-hmm. Vail to Juneau. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, I'm going back for the fifth time this summer with Campus Crusade. Mm-hmm. So that risk really has turned into something that's just been incredibly life-giving for me throughout the last, gosh, like 8 years, 7 years now. So it's pretty crazy.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest risks I took was I transferred colleges after my freshman year. To be a little bit closer to home, but still always had that desire to study abroad. And I kept pushing it out of my mind. I got into a relationship and got really good friends. And the thought of leaving for a whole semester just seemed like really daunting. And you miss out on so much. And I'm kind of a social butterfly, so I don't want to do that. But one day I had a lady come up to me and she said, you have one more day to sign up. So I signed up and I ended up studying abroad in the Netherlands last year from January to May. Definitely one of the best decisions of my life, and it was kind of one of those things where you just step out and do it, and it was very scary. I'd never been out of the country before, never been that far away from my family, and yeah, ended up being just something really amazing. So at times those risks, I think, can really bring you to the next level of your life, where like they take you out of your comfort zone to the extreme for such a good reason, because it makes you see life from a different perspective. Even just like being in Juneau or whatever we're all just talking about, it's just like takes you out of what you're used to and makes you use different parts of your personality and to really rely on God in situations where you're not used to being in a sense.
Yeah.
I think it's so interesting how we've all kind of shared how sometimes you only have a few minutes to make a decision that can really affect years of your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it is, like Matthew said, you know, so many of these decisions are being made by people that don't really have the life experience under our belts to be wisely really assessing many things that are, which is why good godly counsel is helpful. I think probably mine is, although actually, I mean, mine is just, I have a whole laundry list, I think, of ones I could go through, because I think the times that I haven't taken risks in my life are probably shorter and fewer and far between. But one was in college, in between my sophomore and junior years. They gave, at the end of the school year, I went to a Christian college, and they gave these sheets out that asked you how you wanted to be involved in chapel. And you could sing, or you could read scripture, or pray, or whatever, because they had student-led chapels and different elements where they would incorporate students.
Was flute playing
and when
on one of the checkboxes?
It was, but yeah, I had definitely played my flute up at that point. But so one of the boxes was speak in chapel. And by speaking in chapel, you were the speaker. And it was not like a little impromptu whatever, you spoke for like 30 to 40 minutes.
Wow.
And I remember checking the box and saying to myself, you know, I don't know if there's anything that I would share or anything I have to share, but I'm sure they're going to have some kind of informational meeting about this, so I'm going to check it and just see what's up, you know, keep my
Assume
options
and
open
go.
Tomorrow you can speak tomorrow.
And so that summer I went home and I got a letter, and it said your chapel date is October 16th. And I just like flipped out. I was like, what in the world? And so I picked up the phone to call and say, there's been a mistake. I thought this was just an inquiry. But I decided to go through with it and spoke that fall, and eventually became the student chapel coordinator and spoke two more times in chapel.
And here you are today.
And it's kind of like, that was really the turning point for me to realize that I actually can speak in front of people. Because I had never, you know, it's not that I wasn't outgoing or talkative or whatever, but I had never thought that I, one, had anything to say, or two, that I could present it in a way that was helpful or do it without completely imploding. So it was very fearful, a fearful thing for me. And, but yeah, I think ultimately a good thing. So, and interesting just how it has come about that way, and many other things, you know, where my strength and weakness is probably agreeing that I can do things that I'm not really sure I can do. I'm just like, someone will say, yeah, can you do this? And I'm like, yeah, probably, you know, whatever, I'll do it. And it's something crazy. And then I, you know, I've probably lost years off of my life from agreeing to do certain things. And one of my first, less than a year after I started here, I took over, my boss had left, and I took over that team in PR, and I was the youngest person on the team, and I was like, yeah, I can do this job. And I'd never managed anyone before, I didn't know what I was talking about, but, you know, just stepped into that. So kind of some craziness on that front. But have you guys ever had, so let's talk about risk as far as, now when you look back on these situations, decisions that you've made, ways that you've stepped out, what really has changed in your life? Like, how are you different, either, you know, yourself different, or really your circumstances different, as far as ways that you could say, you know, okay, had I done it differently, I probably would be heading down this path, but now I'm heading down this path, and I really see it in retrospect as something that's good.
Had I not studied abroad, it is interesting to like think where I would be, but where it has taken me from there, I've learned so much, and I found things I was interested in by doing that, and I grew as a person. I grew in my spiritual life. While I was there, my computer broke down, so I had like no contact with home. So it just really like stretched me to be able to take risks by relying on God, instead of like okaying it with my family, okaying things with my friends, but making those decisions on my own with God's guidance. So I really see how that impacted me in the decisions that I make now, is being able to do it a little bit more independently, instead of relying on, like, you know, your comfortable circle of people that are going to help you out with things like that. And I see just like career, the way it's leading me, like more of like international interests and like understanding ministry in a different way, and seeing that God's needed in other places, like a more broad understanding of Europe in that sense, and just seeing like hungry people there and here in a sense of people that need God.
Mm-hmm.
So I see how it leads me now.
Yeah. You were mentioning your checklist that you chose chapel speaker. Going back to journalism school for a second, I transferred from a community college partway through my college career. And while I was filling out the application for Michigan State, go Spartans, it said that if you had this many number of credits, you had to choose a major. And I did not have a major, and I did have that many number of credits. So I'm going through the checklist. No, can't do that, can't do that, can't do that, for sure not that. And journalism was there, and I was like, yeah, I could do that. Check the box, just because I had to apply and I had to choose a major. And obviously that's been a defining choice in my life just from the checklist.
That's cool.
I feel like a lot of the risks or decisions that I made in the past, I haven't seen the fruit of it yet. But I know I believe in the value of taking risks and like just stretching myself and hoping that one day that will pay off. But I think I'm in a waiting period right now just to see how that turns out.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like going to Alaska was, I mean, it just makes me, it has made me more adventurous. Just kind of, you know, on that project, we kind of have this assume and go kind of attitude. And it's really good for someone like me who's like, okay, let's plan this all out and let's think of the risks first, you know. But additionally, like I think of, you know, I mean, having worked at Focus twice, having been let go twice, I can see God telling or, you know, saying like ministry is a good thing for you, but I want you out in the world, you know? And so now I'm in grad school, you know, I'm part-time and work with Campus Crusade part-time. And really, as Martha was saying, you don't necessarily see positive fruit right away. And a lot of the fruit that I see right now is kind of this wondering or thinking, you know, here I am, my job is to tell students, other students about the gospel and to disciple students and do Bible study with them. And yet my being in grad school causes me to doubt quite a bit, you know? And so I feel like I've been kind of forced out, you know, into the world, kicked out of the nest and into a world of a lot of doubt and questioning. I mean, that's just what is in the academy. And so while I'm taking this risk of working for Campus Crusade, I also have all these doubts a lot of the time too. But I just have to continue moving forward despite the doubts, knowing that this is God's calling or believing that this is God's calling for my life, and just knowing that there's going to be that tension there, and kind of it's uncomfortable a lot of the time, that tension. But just moving forward despite it, and you know, looking forward to seeing fruit as you know, fruit that feels good as in so far as like seeing students come to Christ or developing relationships with my fellow grad students. So right now, because of the current risks, there's a lot of tension.
Yeah.
It's not bad though.
Yeah. So did you, just in looking back on that story then, have there been times where you've thought either because of your current doubts or because of your story, you know, looking back and saying, okay, I was laid off from Focus twice. Was I really supposed to be at Focus in the first place? I mean, how do you reconcile?
Right.
I mean, that's just kind of weird, you know, because a lot of people think that unless they have this very even path, it means that somehow something was messed up.
You know, it's funny. That really hasn't, I've joked about that with friends, but I've never doubted that. I've never doubted that I was supposed to be at Focus for the two different jobs that I had. And I've really seen how God kind of has shown me, okay, I want you to do ministry, but I also want you to be in academics, you know, and to kind of have a foot in each of those worlds. And I was able to do that in both of my jobs here at Focus. And so I've seen God grow me in those ways, and also just the fact that I've had to you know, take a step and you know, get out of bed each morning after, you know, after a layoff. And I think God has used that to make me see that, you know what, like, you're not going to be, your identity isn't going to be based on your job or even a career, a steady career path. It's not going to be based on a paycheck. And so I just feel like, you know, I think it's in John 15 where Jesus is talking about pruning the branches. Like, I just feel like that's what it is. And so as stressful as it's been, I'm strangely, in a very strange way, when I'm recounting it like this, I'm really thankful for it, because I can see it helps me to believe that God is using me now and has been active throughout the whole story. I think I was supposed to be here at Focus two different times, you know.
Yeah, and one thing leads to the next.
Yeah. And one thing totally leads to the next. And like, I'd always wanted to go to grad school, and then the opportunity came because I was laid off. You know, again, that was a risk I probably wasn't going to take. You know, I needed to be forced out of the job I was in, even though it was a great job. And I look back on it with kind of these rose-colored glasses, but
yeah,
thinking that was, you know, the time of my life. But at the same time, I wouldn't give up what I've learned in grad school and the relationships I have through that, you know, for the world. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Have any of you guys ever taken relationship risks? Anything in that sphere?
I just have to jump in right there. But people will tell me, oh, that was really risky. Oh, that was risky. And I'm like, what are you even talking about? Like when we talked the other day, Lisa. And specifically that always comes up, like if you go on a blind date or you meet someone online and you have coffee with them. And people are like, well, aren't you scared about going into Starbucks and meeting someone for coffee? I mean, what if they're a serial killer? And I'm like, well, anyone in Starbucks on any day of the week could be a serial killer. Are you terrified every day when you get your coffee? Mm-hmm. So to me, obviously you want to be safe, but I don't really understand when people freak out about perfectly safe situations.
Yeah.
You seem very level-headed. I, on the other hand, I mean, I had my little stint of online dating, I'll say, but that was very risky. Like, I felt like I was really putting myself out there and who knows what would happen, or I mean, not in the sense I'd get killed, but just like, what are they going to think of me, or I don't know.
Well, and it hasn't exactly worked out for me, but you know, it's still worth it. Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about, you know, what those risks have produced in your life. So when I took that risk to study abroad, I took the risk of leaving that relationship, and it ended while I was gone. So then it was coming back to that and trying to mend it and decide to take the risk to take it up again and to try again, to give it another chance. So, you know, we talk about if we that's really where God wanted us, because I remember thinking that at the time when I was gone, it was like, was studying abroad worth ending this relationship? But I see now how, you know, God used all those steps in that process to mature me, to strengthen me, to be in that relationship for a second time, to try it again as a stronger person, you know, closer to the Lord, and being able to embark on a relationship together, having had a little bit of space and time to mature. So I would never think that, you know, going abroad was a bad decision because it ended the relationship, but instead seeing the process of, like, you know, God really using that time to strengthen me, and then being able to, you know, just being humble and be like, let's try it again, and, you know, use that encouragement from others and the strength that God gave to learn in that time of doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. I think definitely too, you know, as I think about it, as you get older, there's much more of a risk in being in relationship, because what you're used to is your pattern and what you're used to. I mean, when I was in college, I probably wouldn't have thought anything of it because I didn't think of myself as single. I thought of myself as in college. You know, it wasn't the same thing in my head. And so to assume that in a very short period of time I would be dating and or married, whatever, wasn't a big deal for me. Now when I look at it, it's like, it really is what in my life would change and what would I give up? And there's probably a lot, probably some of which I don't even acknowledge. And I definitely have guy friends who in their 30s or even some in their 40s who got married, and it was really a huge change for them. And to say, you know, God, why would I be single this whole chunk of my life to now enter marriage, you know, and a couple of them married like single moms, you know, and to take that on and to take on someone else's kids and realize that I'm completely going to transform my story and it's going to be totally different. I think that's pretty big. But do you guys ever look at someone else's life, maybe someone who has taken a lot of risks, and say, I wish I was that person, or I wish all those exciting opportunities that they have are because they're this amazing person who's willing to take all these risks?
I never want to do that. So I feel like I am that person to myself. Like, because I have friends that always say that, like, I wish I could do that. And so I'm always just like, you can, just do it. So
sometimes I view those people as impulsive.
Yeah,
no
that
offense.
Would be me.
You know, like, it freaks me out a little bit. I'm like, I don't know how you do that. So I don't necessarily hold them up as role models.
But yeah, I don't.
The outcome of it, you know, can definitely be jealous of that.
I would see it more as a personality issue, where I hold people up like, wow, their personality is so fun. Wow, they can just do anything at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't necessarily see them as, wow, they take a lot of risks, because I would see that as negative.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I envy the other side of it. It's like, I wish I was more level-headed and like took more time to make decisions, because sometimes those impulse decisions don't result in such, you know, awesome rewards. So yeah. I think it's good to find like a happy medium or a level spot.
Yeah.
I definitely think of, like, you know, particular authors or thinkers that I really admire and think to myself, you know, how could I become that, you know, how could I do that? And I think, I don't know, for me, part of me is afraid that I'm idolizing kind of the fame that they have. And so I kind of take a step back and say, okay, I don't need to worry about being popular like they are. But I don't take the risk that it takes to get where they are, because like that road is unknown. And I tend to, on the other side of the spectrum, on the other swing of the pendulum, I idolize like understanding. Mm-hmm. And if I don't understand how I'm going to get there, I don't want to go there. In one instance, I'll be like, oh, well, I don't want that much attention. You know, that would be bad for me. And yet I don't want to take the risks that they've taken, you know. So it's kind of, I don't know how to find that balance. Or I should say, it's not I don't know how to find it. It's tricky looking for that balance of taking the risk, but then also doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah. I think it is different, too, because you think to yourself when you're thinking of certain authors, okay, am I really willing to? Maybe one of them packed all his belongings in a van and drove across mm-hmm. the U.S. and then wrote about it. Or, you know, what's her name who cooked out of Julia Child's cookbook for an entire year and wrote about it. You're like, who thinks of these things? Mm-hmm. And then you think of like the C.S. Lewis's that were like, here's a guy who sat in the kilns, occasionally went to a pub, and then wrote all this craziness, having not, you know, traveled much in his entire life. And so it's just, I think both of those are kind of daunting mm-hmm. things. You think, wow, you either have this amazing imagination or you have these amazing experiences, and mm-hmm. kind of puts it out there a little bit. But I would agree with you, Chelsea, that I am very much, and I think this is kind of an aspect of the risk taker, is I've taken so many risks in my life that I was the hamster in the wheel for quite a while. And it was like I was always onto something new, never sure of the next thing. Would get very frazzled at never being in a state of rest. And now I've had a good stretch of time where I've had the same job, I've lived in the same house, and it's kind of a comforting thing. I think we have to realize that, sure, it may be great to stretch yourself and be out there and do a bunch of different things and be willing to step up to the plate and say, I can do this and I'm going to venture into the unknown. But sometimes it's good to just rest too and to reflect, mm-hmm. you know, where you are, because you can't live an entire life on the frenzy of adrenaline. And
yeah, I'm not ready for that. Like I tell my sister-in-law, I'm ready for curtains. Like mm-hmm. I want to like stay in one place for more than 3 months and like make a good church decision, a place to stay, have friends, a church family. So
that's a good book title. I'm ready for curtains.
Yeah.
but speaking of world famous authors, I'm trying to write a book. Mm-hmm. But as you were saying, sometimes risks aren't good, and sometimes risks don't work out, or you don't get the second chance with the boyfriend. You know, I've sent my book proposal to every book publisher that I've ever heard of, mm-hmm. and haven't made any progress on that so far. And you know, it's hard because it's like, okay, I took all the risks, I did everything I was supposed to do, I take everyone's advice, and nothing. Mm-hmm. So you know, like Martha was saying, sometimes it's just wait mm-hmm. and see how it's going to work out.
Yeah. And not feel like just because you are in a period of waiting it means you have to go blaze yourself away and take more risks, or just be, you know, spin out of control. You know, no one needs that. So, well, very cool, you guys. I think this has been a good discussion, and obviously, even helpful for me as I've thought about it. I was like, wow, you know, because I'm always this goal setter. Every year I have to like set some goals, and I have to make sure that, you know, I've achieved XYZ. But I think there's a good argument for, you know, doing what God calls you to do. And sometimes it is very stretching, and sometimes he'll throw you in there if you're not moving along quickly enough. But sometimes it's good to just step back and rest too, and learn from where you are from staying put. So, well, good. Hopefully we'll get some good insights. Folks out there, write to us, editor@boundless.org. And then stay tuned now for our culture segment, which is going to talk about the whole issue of money and risk-taking in that. And one of the chapters is specifically on being risky with your money and when is it good and when isn't it. So more risks to come. So great. Thanks, you guys.
Awesome.
Thank you.
I can't say that everything's okay, I can see the tears you're crying, and I can't promise to take the pain away, but you can know I won't stop trying. I'll be the angel by your side, I will get you through the night, I'll be the strength you can't provide. on your own. 'Cause when you're down and out of time, and you think you've lost the fight, let me be the angel by your side.
Well, hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am very privileged to have Amy Streeter in the studio. Amy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Amy is the Associate Pastor for Financial Stewardship at New Life Church here in Colorado Springs. I have never heard that title before.
Well, we just kind of...
What kind of churches have Associate Pastors for Financial
Not very many. It's a very important issue, though, and it's kind of a churchy way of saying I help people with personal finance. Mm-hmm. We just call it financial stewardship. But mm-hmm. anything related to helping people build up their savings, get out of debt, that's a huge part of what I do. And just make sure that they are on track with a financial plan that mirrors God's best for their life. That's what I do.
Huh, that's pretty cool. Amy also is a former journalist, a prize-winning journalist, in fact, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for a story that she did, a Texan, and now here in Colorado Springs dealing with the additional lack of humidity, I guess I would say, here in Colorado. And you are the author now of your first book, which is called Your Money, God's Way, Overcoming the 7 Money Myths That Keep Christians Broke. And what I like about this book is what you said kind of in a descriptor here. This is kind of a unique topic because you say this isn't a how to get out of debt book or a savings book or a budgeting book. This is a book to help you finally understand why you don't do the things you say you want to do with your money. Which I think is huge for our audience especially, because I think that, you know, we're talking to young adults here, many of whom probably think money's not something I have to worry about now because I have my whole life ahead of me, or I don't even make any money, so why do I have to worry about what I do make? And so a lot of unique challenges here. But I love the way you open the book because you share some of your own story, which is, I think, so helpful because a lot of people think that people's stories of successful stewardship are unattainable for themselves, but you really did climb your way out. Tell us a little bit about that.
We did. Well, it's a fun story. We hit rock bottom in that we racked up over $100,000 in credit card debt. Hmm. And I can't even tell you what I had to show for that. It was just $10 here and $20 there. And we literally $5 and $10 our way into overwhelming debt. Hmm. And you know, a lot of young people think, well, I don't need to think about this until I get married. But the truth is, my bad money patterns started in my early 20s. When I was a teenager, I was doing everything the right way. I was a saver. I read Money Magazine along with 17 and all the other teen magazines. Hmm. And I paid cash for my first car. I got a full scholarship to study journalism in college. So I started out really well. But then the better things got for me, the more I thought I was entitled to. And I started overspending and I started racking up debt. And when I was in college in the early 90s, they gave away credit cards like candy.
Hmm, yeah,
and
that's true.
So I left college probably with about $8,000 or $9,000 in credit card debt, which didn't really seem like a whole lot. But that pattern started of, well, if I want something, I'm not going to wait for it. I'm going to get it now because I can. And when I met my husband, the man who is now my husband, I was 19 and I already had thousands of dollars in credit card debt. And we have pictures that he took of me at 20 cutting up my credit cards, and at 22 cutting up my credit cards again, and at 24. And then finally, we just stopped taking the pictures because it was a pattern. Mm-hmm. And we would get, and unfortunately, when I met him, he didn't even have a credit card. So I had the opportunity to educate him on all the fun we could have.
On how to spend.
Poor man. God bless him. But we started that pattern early in our relationship, early in our friendship. We brought it into our marriage, and those bad habits escalated. Even though I started out with the head knowledge, my behavior and my attitudes were so skewed. I mean, how could someone who's reading Money Magazine and pays cash for her first car at 18 go to someone who has $100,000 in credit card debt? It's very, very easy. And it's not about our head knowledge. It's about what's going on in our heart, what's going on in our spirit, what do we feel like we're entitled to, and where's the reluctance to wait for mm-hmm. what we want to have.
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with having good things. It's just a matter of waiting until you can actually afford them.
Yeah. And I like what you said about the whole concept of being entitled, because I think that is true. And I think a lot of young adults will think, well,
I have a steady job. I have, you know, I get a regular paycheck. So obviously all of this is going to, you know, it'll come out in the end. It's fine. You know, maybe I can't pay for it right now, but I will be able to because this paycheck will keep coming. And so it's kind of this false sense of security as far as what you have coming.
Absolutely. And we look at our friends, we look at our peers, and we see what they have. And we think that we should be having the same thing, not knowing what their income is or what their debt load is. We just take it for granted that, you know, it's an apples to apples comparison. And if, well, if my best friend has this really nice apartment and it's $250 a month more than what I'm spending, maybe I need to try to go out and get a nicer apartment. Mm-hmm. But she may be up to her ears in debt. She may be making twice what you're making. Unless you know all the variables, there's not really a good way to make a comparison.
Yeah, that's so true. Okay, so you actually break the book down, I think, in a very helpful way. You identify what you're calling counterfeit convictions. And they are things that ultimately kind of are what you call timeless truths. They're actually things that are rooted in truth, things that sound pretty good, and some of them even have biblical roots as far as the intentions behind them, but they can easily get skewed when you think of how you're going to apply them and ways that maybe the devil can kind of subtly influence your thinking as far as how to apply. So I like to go through some of these, and I think some of them are especially potent traps for young adults, including the first couple, the first one being money is going to fix me and my problems. you know, a lot of young adults nowadays are coming out of broken homes, coming out of fatherlessness, and they just think, if I just do this, this, and this, I will be able to turn that pattern around, and my story will be different, and somehow it's going to involve success, and somehow it's going to involve XYZ that I need to have. How have you seen that play out?
Well, I saw it play out in my own life in that my grandmother raised me and I grew up in the church, but our family was just a little bit different than the other church families. And when you don't have the mom and the dad and the brother and the sister, you know, people tend to look at your family and say, well, what's wrong with you? Your family doesn't, you know, where are your parents? And having to explain myself, I felt like growing up, even to other Christians, was very painful. And so when I became an adult, I sort of wanted to even the playing field and show that, hey, I'm just as good as anyone else. I'm just as smart as anyone else. I may have not grown up in a traditional family, but, you know, I'm just as good. And even though that didn't come to the surface, I know now that was a core of some of the pain that was in my heart. And it wasn't until God healed that and showed me who I was in Him that I was able to not use things and not use outward appearances to validate myself to other people, which sounds very lofty and kind of psychobabbly in a way. But, you know, if people can capture some of that in their 20s, it'll save them a lot of grief in their 30s, undoing dumb things to compensate for, you know, not having that parental support or not having that whole intact family that we all would like to have. The wonderful thing is God can take us wherever we are and whatever our situation is and make something amazing out of it. We just have to rise above our circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's true. And it's very, you know, like you said, it's not putting that identity. I mean, again, it's such a cultural buy-in that we have of how things have to look or how our story is going to play out. You kind of segue with that into the idea of blessing and how a lot of people will look at money as an evidence of God's blessing. And they'll do one of two things. They'll either say that my economic success is up to God. I think that's one of the counterfeits that you mm-hmm. identify. And so they just kind of throw everything out. And it's kind of like, well, you know, what can I do? I really shouldn't, you know, worry about it at all. Or they kind of go into the opposite of that and specifically say, well, God will reward me with blessing. And so kind of the you know, the excess of that or kind of the opposite extreme. Do you have, when you sit down, I mean, because you're doing a lot of counseling and you've, you know, worked for two very large churches, you've had a number of people, I'm sure, come through your doors and detail their very specific stories. How do people get from, you know, people that are in the Word of God, people that are understand, people that are under good teaching, and they totally understand and want to honor God with their finances. How do they get from that to being out of control in actual practice?
Well, I think it all goes down to the way that we absorb Scripture. Mm. And a lot of times, the longer you've been a Christian, the harder it is for you to soak in God's word in a fresh way. We just kind of read the verses and we say, oh, well, I know that. Like, godliness with contentment is great gain. You know, we've heard that a million times in church. If you've been a Christian for a few years, you've heard that at least 10 or 15 times. And then you tend to gloss over it in your mind and in your heart and in your spirit. But when you think about it, I mean, those words are very powerful. Godliness, righteousness, you know, pursuing God's best for our lives with contentment is great gain. And I'll have families come in with, they'll own their own home, they'll have a couple of cars, they'll have healthy children, a dog running around in the backyard, but if they don't have what their neighbors have, they're wanting to know how they can get more. And if we can catch them at that point before they start stepping out and doing crazy things to satisfy that lack of contentment and get them to absorb, look around you and see, people with material possessions might trade every penny that they had for what you have, you know, an intact, loving marriage. You can't put a price tag on that. Healthy children, you can't put a price tag on that. Being content with the circumstances that we're in. One of the things that I'm saying a lot in my classes is that because people are, if they're out of work, they're really striving for that job, or if they've had an income cut back, you know, they're stressing out about that, or, you know, gas prices are increasing, food prices are increasing, you know, their budget's out of whack. But what I tell people is God's not going to move you to a better situation until you're stewarding the one that you have. And being content, even in the midst of difficult circumstances, we didn't really start with all of that credit card debt. I was in such a panic mode. It was like throwing me into a pot of boiling water. And, you know, inside of my, in my heart, I mean, I, even though outwardly I looked calm and okay and managed to hold down a job and raise kids, inside I was living in a state of panic. And it wasn't until God showed me that I had to sit down and be still and learn how to be content in the middle of that circumstance and really steward that difficulty, mm-hmm. that he was going to move us to a better place. And so as soon as I accepted that and accepted the work that we were going to have to do and just got really content with it, not that you want to be content with your distress, but understand, you know, where I am today is a product of the choices that I made yesterday, and just kind of be there in that and accept it and work with it and not try to fight it so much, that's when God's going to come in and you're going to start to see him move in your life and you're going to start to see those blessings that you're praying for.
Yeah.
But financial resources to me are one of the least of all of the ways that God can bless us. And when you're in it again, it can sound a little bit trite, but if you're healthy and you have a job, I mean, you're already in the top 1% of people in the world, and just being grateful for that is going to get you to a place where God can fill your life with even more.
Yeah, that's true. Now, how do we deal with that? That brings me to one of the other counterfeit convictions that you talk about, and that is this idea that God rewards risk. And so I forget how you titled the chapter. It was jumping off
the cliff. Jumpers.
Yeah, the cliff jumper. And it's interesting because earlier in this show, we actually talked about some of the benefits of risk, like times in our lives when we, our roundtable talked about, you know, times in our lives when we've stepped out, whether it was moving to a different state, taking a job that we weren't sure about, or taking a risk in a relationship and seeing how God directed us in ways that we didn't think he would. But when it comes to money, I think sometimes people can say, you know, I need to do this crazy thing, and if I do, God's going to reward it, and God's going to, I think there's a almost an underlying, you know, we see in our culture in the church, an underlying, whether it's a prosperity element or whether it's, you know, just some bad teaching as far as do anything you want, and God's going to provide some kind of safety net, and God will do XYZ to rescue you out of that. How does that come into play?
Well, you know, I call it cliff jumping because it's an easy analogy for people to understand, and it's incredibly dangerous. And it was one of the last of the counterfeit convictions that I uncovered, because I would see these great Christian families who, you know, they tithed and they studied God's word and they served in the church. They did everything, you know, on paper the right way, and their lives were a complete and total mess. And unpacking that with these families helped me understand they were taking these huge, bold risks that did not have God's hand on them. And so I had to really start exploring, well, how can you really tell? How can you really know? Because even like when we moved here from Texas, I mean, that was really scary for me to take the job at New Life. My husband had a wonderful job. He was a reporter at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. You know, we loved our home. We loved our neighbors. Our family was there. And we just felt like this was something that God was doing. But how do you know? How can you be sure? And so we sought godly counsel from people who were who had our best interest at heart and who their lives looked like our lives wanted to look. And what I see people do a lot of times is they'll go get advice from people whose lives are a mess. And we all have friends who, you know, God bless them, they're well-meaning, but they dispense advice and they really shouldn't because their lives don't look like we want our lives to look like. So we started getting advice from godly people. We prayed our socks off and we just asked God to confirm for us, to start opening doors for us. And when we moved and we had 3 children, a dog, a cat, you know, 2 trucks full of stuff. I mean, it was a big move for us. But every step of the way, we could tell that God's hand was on it. Before we even left Fort Worth, Scott had freelance work that replaced his income at the Star-Telegram. We had our housing situation was taken care of in a miraculous way that only God could have orchestrated. We had people that we didn't even know, you know, come up to us at church and say, you know, hey, are you guys in some sort of transition? You know, can I pray for you? And things like that were just God giving us, you know, it was baby steps at first until it got to be huge, just buckets of confirmation poured over us that we were doing the right thing. And so when we came, yes, it was scary. Yes, it was difficult, but there was peace on it. But what we have to do is understand the difference between risk for the sake of our own impulsiveness, which is a weakness of mine. I can be very impulsive. I like to do big things. I like to change things up. I like to mix things up. And it can be a lot of fun. But when we take bold steps that don't have God's hand on them, that's when we wreck our lives. And so I always tell people, slow down. God is never, ever, ever in a hurry. And he's going to give us confirmation. He's going to give us verification. If the income is not there, if the job is not there, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's not God. Because maybe once or twice in your entire life, he's going to ask you to take some huge step of faith, but he's still going to confirm it. But I will see people who time after time after time make these huge jumps in their life with no job, with no safety net, with no income attached to it, and then they wonder why God let them down. And that causes a lot of spiritual wounding, and that causes separation from the Lord because people say, well, Lord, you said jump, and I jumped, and you didn't catch me. But it's an assumption that God told them to jump when he didn't. He was telling them to stay right where they are. They just weren't content. They wanted the big change.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And I think it gets back to what we were saying about that slight idea of entitlement. And that is, you know, we see a lot of young adults now who think straight out the gate, you know, I'm going to have this amazing job. It's going to be, we've lost a lot of what our grandparents' generation had in that just slow, steady progress in growing and learning and moving in your career and taking those small steps. And now it's like, if you're not a consultant by the time you're 23, you know, it's just like, what happened? You know, we all want to just organize our own lives and have our own schedules and our own, obviously, crazy disposable income and stuff. I think it's so true. So, okay. So as we close here, Amy, I want you to just talk to, because I think we could have maybe, let's say we're talking to that 24-year-old who, you know, out of college, has a college degree, in their first or second job, third job, maybe, kind of moving along. What are some of those, because they're going to say, okay, well, I don't have a huge house. I don't have multiple cars. I don't have a family right now. What are some of those early warning signs that someone is probably moving in a direction that's making some bad decisions? What are some checkpoints that single young adults need to have to make sure that they are not setting themselves up for massive debt, massive failure, bad stewardship, bad decisions, and bad risks?
Well, get in the habit now of living below your means. Hmm. And the ideal spending ratio for anyone, regardless of how much you make, is 10, 10, 80. You give the first 10% by tithing to your local church. You save the second 10% and you live on the other 80%. If you have debt, if you have student loan debt, make paying that off a priority. Don't take debt into your marriage. Don't take it into your late 20s. Get a second job. Do whatever you have to do and get rid of that debt. And I tell people in counseling all the time, student loan debt is the second worst debt kind of debt that you can have after IRS debt. Because they are the only entity aside from the government that can garnish your wages without taking you to court. And I'll have people come in with a 50% garnishment on their wages, which means the bank is taking 50% of their paycheck and they had no warning because they went into default on their student loans. Mm-hmm. And that can wreck young and tender marriages when, you know, one of the spouses didn't know or didn't know the situation or how bad it was. So if you have student loan debt, if you have any kind of debt, make paying that off a priority. Keep your spending below that 80%. Ideally, to be really comfortable and to be living a really life that's very consistent with the income God has provided for you, really try to keep your spending below 70%. Mm. Avoid car loans if you can at all possible. If you have to get one, pay it off as soon as you can. But just always, always, always don't look at, if you're making $30,000 a year, don't walk into Starbucks thinking, well, I can afford a latte a day because I make $30,000 a year. Well, really you don't. By the time you take out taxes, by the time you pull out for savings, by the time you factor in your giving, you know, you really need to be spending 70% of that $30,000 and live your life accordingly. And you'll never, ever, ever stay up at night wondering how you're going to pay your bills.
Wow. That's good. And I think it is true. I mean, I think there's a kind of a feeling of exhaustion, and maybe you just even have some encouragement for folks here. Cause I know a lot of people think, I'm already working, you know, I've already tried to stay healthy. I'm already trying to exercise. Now I have to throw finances into it. How can I keep all this together? I know, it's like, it's kind of, you know, some people let some things drop, and a lot of times it is finances, and they'll think, you know, because I'm doing so well in all these other areas, God's going to let me, you know, maybe make some concessions here and do, you know, and I think it is, it's a bad philosophy.
Well, and we get into a habit of treating ourselves, you know, when you're tired, and the thing is, it doesn't get easier the older that you get. You think, well, okay, well, I'm, you know, when I get married, then there'll be two incomes and it'll get easier. Well, no, because then the babies come and the expenses just get higher and higher. So just get a hold of this now. Once you get the hang of doing this stuff, you kind of go on autopilot. It's not something, I'm a stewardship pastor and I think about my money once a month. I do my budget once a month. I pay my bills once a month and then I'm done. Then I can focus on everything else that I need to get done in my day. So it's not something that we need to be obsessed with. That's not healthy. It's not something we need to be overly concerned with, but it's so much better to be proactive. It's a lot better to never gain the weight than it is to try to go in and lose the weight. It's a lot better to never incur the debt than it is to have to go in and undo it as someone who spent many, many, many years digging out of a hole.
Yeah. Well, Amy, thanks so much for sharing your own story and obviously your wisdom, not only gleaned from the stuff that you've waded through, but the many, many couples and singles that you've counseled over the years, and just great stuff. The book is called Your Money, God's Way, Overcoming the 7 Money Myths That Keep Christians Broke. So check it out. Again, I think it's just a great foundation for people that think they may be on the verge of a struggle or are just mired in the midst of it. And I think sometimes we don't realize what we're in before we're too overcome by it. So make sure that y'all check that out. So Amy, thank you so much for being part of this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Very fun.
I lost my keys in the great unknown, and call me please, 'cause I can't find my phone. This is the
everyone. We are back and opening up this week's inbox, and I have got one of our other counselors in the studio, a new face and a new voice for us, Christina Browning. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you.
Great to have you. It's so fun that we have fun and helpful that we have a whole bunch of counselors here at Focus on the Family who are helping people day in and day out, who call into our phone lines and send us questions via email. Very exciting to have you guys here to help families navigate a bunch of questions and issues that they may have. So,
absolutely.
Well, you're going to help one of our Boundless listeners here. And she says, I am 26 years old with a full-time job. God has been gracious to put great people around me, and I cannot thank him enough for it. However, I'm starting to realize that people usually don't initiate hanging out with me. I consider myself fairly friendly. I could be shy in big groups, but I'm usually good starting conversations with strangers. For the most part, the first impression I give is friendly and nice, but for whatever reason, people don't seem to just want to be with me, like have lunch or do something that doesn't need a lot of planning. I've been trying to evaluate what I do, how I am, just trying to see good and bad in me, and why people don't seem to just hang out with me for the sake of being with me. I studied myself, talked about it with my mentor, but I just can't figure out what is causing people to just be friendly with me and not much more. How do people make friends? That is a big question.
That is a big question, Lisa. And, you know, my heart just goes out to this reader because it is hard, especially when you move into a new place and you don't have that friend base. And, you know, it sounds like at 26, she's out of school a little bit. And people are set in their friend base. And to be able to enter into that does take time, as this person pointed out. I would really like to encourage her in that she's doing a great job to continue to reach out and, you know, to be able to say that there are times when she's going to have to initiate, times to be able to give it time. My encouragement to her would be to get involved with a life group or a church group that's going to be able to give her a wide base of people to get to know and who will have organized activities, like a church group or a young adults group that can do that on a regular basis. I would also encourage her in, you know, she talks that she's evaluating the good and the bad, and she's talking with mentors, and I'm really glad that she's has a mentor that's helping her in that. But don't overanalyze it. Don't take it to a place where you're questioning who you are based on what other people think, because you are who God created you to be, and that is a wonderful thing. So if people are not wanting to hang out with you, most likely it is not because of who you are, but because people are just busy or they're connected with other groups that they're choosing to spend their time in. So don't take it quite so personally in that it's about you, but maybe about the fact that people are just busy and they love hanging out with you. They're just not connected yet in activities where they have time to give to that.
So. Yeah. No, I think that's great. And I think, Christina, I mean, I totally could not agree more. And I have friends who absolutely have been in this situation, and I've talked with them about it. And usually they come to me and they say, well, Lisa, you don't understand because you're just an extrovert and you just, you know, people like hanging around you. But it is so true what you said about placing yourself in situations where that fellowship, I call it orchestrated fellowship, where right. You know it's going to happen because that's what has been planned. And it's not this awkward, like, hey, will you have a conversation with me? You know,
right.
I mean, you're doing something that's going to bring that about. And I think that is so true. Again, what you said about it is not about her. It is about people being overcommitted, people having many different friendships, some of them very surfacey, maybe some of them going deeper. And I think people get overwhelmed at the idea of, whoa, okay, so this person obviously wants me to add them to my friend group. What does that look like? You know, and it becomes, it can be a little bit too stilted or a little bit too programmed if you don't just let a friendship happen organically in the context of activity. Something even like, I know a lot of church groups will do like a dinners for six or something where you're at someone's house for a reason, you have conversation for a reason, people can get to know you with that. I think that's really helpful.
Exactly. And, you know, I've had a lot of personal experience along this line. I've moved around a lot and I tend to be more shy. It takes me a while to come out of my shell. And so for a long time, I would move to a new place and I would be there for like a year to 2 years and be like, why am I not connecting? And I'm going to these things and people don't talk to me and nobody likes me. And what's wrong with that picture? And I finally had to stop evaluating myself and just be free to say, you know what? I'm going to choose to know the people who are choosing to interact with me. And I'm going to get involved with hobbies or groups that are interested and meet people who have that similar quality. So being able to just continue to reach out in the opportunities that God gives you and work with it, allow it to have time. You know, for me, I know that it's usually takes 2 to 3 years before I'm really connecting with people. So, you know, give it that time for relationships to develop.
Yeah, I think that's helpful too, is to understand that there certainly can be a longer time frame for this. I think mm-hmm. a lot of people, especially if they move to a new area or they try out a new group at church, they think, you know, within a week or two, if I haven't made this bosom friend, then I've failed. Right. And it really is. It's a long process. And I think for those who aren't used to or they haven't had to move or change friendships or change social spheres in a while, it's hard for them to remember that. But it really is a, you know, I would not recommend going up to a person and saying, so anyway, I decided that you're going to be my friend, and here's my 9 steps that I'm going to take to getting there. That is freaky and overwhelming.
Right. Yeah, so, I wouldn't encourage people to do that.
But to definitely say, to take on some of the responsibility, just as you said, Christina, and say, you know what? I'm going to throw something at my house. I'm going to have a dinner, an informal game night or something, right. and I'm going to invite people. Even though right. there's no code to say, like, you have to be in a circle of people for X number of months before you can do that, you know? And I think, right. I think it's helpful, and it shows initiative, and it allows some of your personality to shine through.
Exactly. And even if you know, even if nobody shows up to those events that you've planned and you've invited people to come over for dinner, and then you're like, okay, only one person came and it was really weird and awkward, or nobody showed up and you're like, you know, I'm never doing that again. I would encourage you, keep doing it. Keep planning things, because people will start coming. The more that you offer, the more that you're available, people will start coming. And then, you know, if you've given it like 3 to 6 months and nobody is coming and you're still in the same place, then my encouragement is to then start reaching out in other already planned ministry opportunities. So start getting involved in your church and start doing different activities that are pre-planned by other people. And then through that, you will develop friendships that then may link off to other activities outside of that.
Yeah. Well, great thoughts, Christina. Thanks for weighing in on that. I think that's really helpful, and a lot of practical things that this person can take and start implementing as well. So
Thank you. Good
stuff. All right. That is it for this week's show. Again, we want to hear from you. Please write to us with your questions and your comments, editor@boundless.org, so we can address them on a future show. That is it for this week's show. Make sure that you're hanging in with us. And for those of you who want to get more info on what we have, the advice, the resources that come out of our counseling department, go to focusonthefamily.com. And you can search by issue, you can search by stage of life, just a number of different things, resources. You will find all of that there. So that is it. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.